Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up in just a few moments, putting faith into action. A former hostage in Iraq talks about his experiences and why he believes the church should do more to promote non-violent means of conflict resolution. Protecting the River Jordan, why environmental groups are raising the alarm over the critical state of water in the place where Jesus was baptized. But first, Pope Benedict XVI speaks about the importance of apostolic tradition in his weekly general audience. Welcome to the programme. All Christians must listen to their bishops and to the Church in Rome, which is the cornerstone of apostolic tradition. That was Pope Benedict XVI's message to the thousands of visitors and pilgrims to St. Peter's Square this Wednesday for his open-air weekly audience. Continuing his catechesis on the Church Fathers, Pope Benedict turned to St. Irenaeus of Lyon, a great theologian and bishop from the late 2nd century.
In his writings, Irenaeus clearly sets forth the contents of the apostolic faith and appeals to the Church's living tradition in order to defend that faith from false teachings. He thus emphasizes the regula fides, the rule of faith, contained in the Apostles' Creed and in the Gospels proclaimed by the Church's bishops.
Pope Benedict said the gospel that Irenaeus preached was the gospel preached by his teacher, Polycarp, who in turn received it from the Apostle John in an unbroken line of succession going back to Christ himself.
Irenaeus also writes of the unique authority of the Church of Rome as founded on the apostles. The zealous pastor illustrates for us three important characteristics of the apostolic tradition. It is public because it is available to all through the teaching of the bishops. It is one because its content remains the same despite the variety of languages and cultures. And it is pneumatic because through it the Holy Spirit continues to enliven and renew the Church even today.
Pope Benedict then welcomed the many English-speaking pilgrims present in St. Peter's Square.
I am pleased to welcome the many English-speaking pilgrims present. Upon all of you, I invoke God's blessings of peace and joy.
Putting faith into action can mean different things to different people, but for some, living out the faith can lead to difficult, even dangerous situations. That's exactly what happened to retired biophysics professor Norman Kemba, a Baptist and committed peace campaigner who felt he should be doing more to put his Christian principles into practice. Inspired by the words and witness of German Lutheran pastor Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was hanged for his outspoken opposition to the Nazi regime, Kemba joined a Christian peacemaker team travelling to Iraq in November 2005. Just a few days after the start of their mission, he and his three companions were kidnapped in broad daylight and held chained together in a Baghdad suburb until three of them were set free by Allied soldiers on March 23, 2006. The fourth member of their team, American Tom Fox, was shot by his captors and his body dumped on a street in the war-torn Iraqi capital.
When he'd gone, we said, "How is he?" And they said, "Oh, he's all right. He's at another house. And we're looking after him." But gradually we came to realise that some misadventure had befallen him.
Norman Kemba is not a man who talks easily about his emotions, about the fear and dread he must have felt as the weeks and months of captivity dragged on. Many of the most dramatic moments, he says, are no longer clear in his mind, though he has written a book to try and work through this traumatic experience. What remains clear to him, though, is the conviction that people of faith should be open to the challenge of putting their principles into practice.
Well, I was a conscientious objector to military service from my college days. I've been active in the Christian peace movement ever since. And then I met the Mennonites, who are a peace church rather like the Quakers. They had been challenged that Christian peacemakers should seek in their work to bring about peace non-violently, should be prepared to take the same sort of risks that young men take in trying to bring about peace in their belief by using violence. And I had the opportunity to go with, as a delegate, not a full member, with a Christian peacemaker team to Iraq. And that's how I came to be there.
Did you feel at the time that you were taking a pretty big risk in going there?
No, I wasn't. I knew there were risks, but I didn't think it was a large risk because a number of delegations had been to Iraq before and had not come to any harm.
So can you tell us a little bit about the circumstances of your capture? There were four of you, weren't there?
Yes. The Christian peacemaker team in Baghdad arranged various visits, including a visit to a Chaldean Catholic church, and we also went to a power station. Then, to make things even, we went to see a Shia cleric, and then we went off to meet a Sunni cleric, and that was at a mosque in a rather isolated place. And when we were being driven away, suddenly a car stopped in front of ours, out jumped armed men, and we were duly kidnapped.
What do you remember about your emotions, your feelings at that time?
I seem to have managed to quash those memories rather too well. In my book, I say it was almost an out-of-body experience. You know, is this what kidnap is like? I must have been frightened, but I can't remember it. And the exact event isn't too clear in my mind.
And then you were taken into captivity, weren't you, where you stayed for 4 months. Now, tell us a little bit about that. What, for example, do you remember as being the hardest part of your ordeal?
I think perhaps it was the boredom was the worst aspect. I mean, there were four of us initially, and we didn't know each other very well. We'd only met a few days before we were captured in Jordan, and we agreed a schedule of half an hour of prayer, which we took according to our own tradition. We agreed a period of Bible study, which is amusing when you don't have Bibles. We had an agreed period of quiet, and then we told life stories and we played some games and so on. So that's how we passed our day. But of course we were handcuffed together, one to each, sat on four chairs in the same room for most of those months, and also handcuffed together at night, slept on the floor on a sort of futon thing, and it was the boredom, I think, that was trying.
You obviously got to know each other extremely well, as you say, during those months. What was it like then when one of your member, Tom Fox, was taken and maybe you didn't know he had been killed the first of all?
No, well, the people who looked after us, there was only one who spoke English, but they were experts at lying. I don't know whether their job was to keep us happy, but they made an excuse why Tom Fox should be taken from us to make release easier. When he'd gone, we said, how is he? And they said, oh, he's all right. He's at another house and we're looking after him. But gradually we came to realise that some misadventure had befallen him. And when we were released, one of the first questions that Jim Loney asked the soldiers was, where's Tom Fox? And it was then that we learnt that he'd been murdered.
What were your feelings at that point towards your captors?
Well, I think, of course, the captors were off the scene And the whole business of being released was so rushed and chaotic that we didn't, you know, I can't remember having any particularly strong feelings. It was later in the British Embassy in Baghdad that the three of us, before we parted, got together and had a brief time of remembrance of Tom Fox, and we sang a song that he liked.
What do you feel now, looking back at this experience? I mean, you describe it as perhaps almost an out-of-body experience at times, but what do you feel now about the way it has affected your life?
My chief regret is the effect that it had on my wife, who had 4 months of extreme anxiety, not knowing whether I was alive or dead. But on the other hand, it's had all sorts of unexpected results. Well, there's a wonderful demonstration of the Worldwide Fellowship of the Church. People of all denominations supported my wife. The Muslim community supported us and worked for us. So there were links made between Christians and Muslims. And then I've got the opportunity to talk about Christian peacemaking on Vatican Radio. That can't be a bad thing, can it?
If you were asked to return to Iraq now, what would you say?
I don't think that I could do anything useful at all. I mean, my original intention was fairly simple. It was just to meet Iraqi people, reassure them that not everybody in the West was their enemies.
Do you think that's still an important message to be trying to get across?
I think it is, but I think the conditions in Baghdad at present are so dangerous that it would be difficult to do it.
We're marking 4 years since the Allied troops moved into Iraq. What is your view on the current situation? As you know, public opinion is somewhat polarised. There are many, many people calling for a complete withdrawal of British and American troops. What are your views on that?
I consider myself not an expert on Iraq. I know a lot about 150 square feet of Iraq. I studied that for 3 months. But I know no more about Iraq than anybody else who reads the papers with discrimination and intelligence. I would tend to, because I've always been opposed to the war, I'm opposed to armed conflict as a method of bringing about peace. I would tend to think that taking the troops out would not be harmful to the situation.
As you say, one of the hardest things was the situation for your wife and for the families of those who were held hostage with you. What is your message to families in similar situations who have loved ones currently held hostage?
Well, my hope is that they will be supported, as my wife and family was, by their churches, by the, in this case, the police family liaison officers, by the Foreign Office, just amazing support.
There's a lot of focus, of course, on the Western hostages who are held in Iraq and indeed other places. But I understand that there are maybe dozens of Iraqis kidnapped almost every day. And yet there is almost no attention given to their plight. Would you have a message to them, to their families?
Yes, well, I regard myself as a bit of a fraud, because what happened to me was a minor blip, as somebody said, compared with the terrible tragedy of life in Baghdad today.
What do you think is the value of the work of groups like your own, the peacemaking teams and so on? How much can they really help to support those who are suffering as a result of this war?
Well, they have done quite a lot. I mean, they're now in northern Iraq, in the Kurdish area, and they have done a lot to identify human rights abuses and to help people in various situations. And so their work in Iraq should not be underestimated.
What else can Christians do, perhaps, to support those who are suffering at the moment as a result of the conflict?
I think there are some agencies still able to work in Iraq, but there aren't very many because the situation there is so dire.
What are you perhaps hoping to do? You've written a book about your experience. What else do you plan to do, if anything, to try and, if you like, put this experience at the service of others?
I shall continue to talk about non-violence. I think that the church has been very deficient in its advocation of non-violence. We haven't celebrated the victories of non-violence. I mean, I hope that all Roman Catholics know about the wonderful story of the overthrow of the Marcos regime in the Philippines. But that's just one among so many examples of non-violent victories. And I feel the church should celebrate it and ask politicians why aren't they pursuing non-violent approaches to conflict resolution.
My thanks there to Norman Kemba, whose book Hostage in Iraq is published by Darton Longman and Todd. And for more on the Christian Peacemaker teams, you can see their website at www.cpt.org. For Christians, the River Jordan is closely associated with the life and mission of Jesus, especially with the gospel account of how he was baptized in its waters. Yet anyone wishing to be baptized by immersion in the water of this river today could be putting his or her health at serious risk. And in the future, there may not even be much of a river at all, just a very small stream. That's because the River Jordan is now mostly made up of raw sewage, and its flow has been reduced by more than 90% because the countries that border its banks have diverted nearly all of its fresh water. The Jordan is of great symbolic importance not just for Christians but also for Muslims and Jews, yet few people in the area are aware of how serious this problem has become. One group that is campaigning to raise awareness of this holy river's plight is Friends of the Earth Middle East. It's a unique organization that groups together Jordanian, Israeli and Palestinian environmentalists who, despite the political tensions which divide their nations, have joined together in a common effort to preserve their shared environment and promote peace building. The Palestinian head of the organization, Nadar Khatib, spoke to my colleague Susie Hodges about his concerns.
Unfortunately, it can easily be described as a catastrophe in all terms of environment, water, human needs, all these things. It's too bad situation. We never got to that any time before in the history.
So is the river, in a sense, heading for an ecological death unless urgent action is taken?
Yeah, the river is drying up nowadays. The reason is the diversion of the freshwater resources in the upper parts of the Jordan. The Israelis, since 64, have diverted the upper Jordan tributaries. No single drop of freshwater is coming out of Lake Piperia now. And the Jordanians and the Syrians also, they are capturing the upper resources of the Yarmouk River. And recently, with the construction or finishing the construction of the Unity Dam, no fresh water will be flowing from the Yarmouk River to the lower Jordan anymore. The end result is only little amounts, less than 5 to 10% of the original flow will be flowing, most of which is raw sewage and brackish water.
So if somebody nowadays were to, say, get baptized in the River Jordan, they would be presumably risking their health.
We look to the water quality in the Jordan River as unhealthy water. There is some potential risks. It's very important mainly for the Christians, because they have to be baptized in the Jordan River, and that is not the best water quality we used to have in the Jordan River. So definitely there is a need to do something to improve the water quality flowing in the River Jordan for many reasons, on top of which is the holistic nature of the river, mainly for the Christian.
This is a river, of course, that's holy to Muslims, Jews and Christians. Is there a lot of awareness of the river's plight among the people of these different religions in the Middle East?
Unfortunately, because of the current political nature surrounding the Jordan River, the public in the region are not much aware, because since 1967, both banks of the River Jordan are like military zones. From the western side, nobody can have an access, especially from the Palestinian side, and Palestinians have no control whatsoever. In the Jordanian side, there is more access, especially in the last years, but for the general public, they are not much aware, and they do not see what is happening in the river. They know about it from what they read in the books, from the religion, but actually they don't see what is happening on the ground, and that is a major concern for us, because the people cannot react enough to rehabilitate or to stop the degradation that is happening in the Jordan River.
As you said earlier, Israel, Jordan and Syria all trying to divert as much clean water as they can from the River Jordan. Is this often a source of contention between the countries?
The Jordan River has been a major issue within the Arab-Israeli conflict for more than 50 years. And the no cooperation, I would say, has been a major reason for the current situation of the Jordan River. And unfortunately, most of the water that is used for agriculture and diverted outside the basin, mainly by Israel, is not really paying for its prices. And we need really to rethink about all our policies regarding the water management, mainly for agriculture.
What proposals is your organization making to try to save the River Jordan and to bring it back to at least a vestige of its former health?
In our organization, we are working with different levels. We are lobbying with the international organizations like the UN to declare that region as a worldwide important area in terms of natural and cultural heritage. So no uncontrolled development will ever take place in that area. We work with the public to inform them what is happening and how we can work together, and to encourage them to cooperate within the region on both sides, because the Jordan River is important for everybody. Also, we send messages to the decision makers asking them to reform their policies of water management to try to rehabilitate the river and allow more fresh water to flow again in the River Jordan, and to think about sustainable development. The people within the Jordan Basin are the poorest in the region, despite the fact that they produce most of the food for the area. And also, we try to convince them that this is one ecosystem, and unless everybody works together, we cannot really succeed in the way we are looking for. And we need to recognize the needs of everybody as equals and as human beings who want to live in peace, dignity and harmony within our region, so that all the three nations, the Palestinians, the Israelis and the Jordanians mainly, of course we are looking also to the Syrians and the Lebanese, to work together to rehabilitate that part. We tell them that the conflict only have created more problems, destroyed our environment, and we need to think about a comprehensive and justice peace for everybody within our region.
It's quite unusual to have such a close cooperation, an organization where you have Palestinians and Israelis and Jordanians and other Arab nations working closely together. I mean, as a Palestinian, do you sometimes get criticized for working in close cooperation with Israel?
Well, I think all of us within Palestine or Israel or Jordan, between time to time, there are some minorities who might criticize our work. But we are people who believe in justice, peace, in the right of the Palestinian to have an independent state within the 1967 borders and ending the Israeli military occupation. We recognize that environment knows no borders. We recognize that we are all human beings. We need to recognize each other's rights and to work together rather than competing with each other for nothing. So we have a common base that we stand on. And criticizing from here and there will not affect us as long as we believe in what we are doing, and we think that we are on the right track, because in many cases, the people who criticized us here in the past, they are coming and joining us and supporting us nowadays and afterwards.
Apart from its water, why else is the River Jordan so important in environmental terms?
Well, the River Jordan is very rich in both natural and cultural heritage sites. It has many places very important, not only for the region, but for the world. The Jordan River, it has the baptism site of Jesus Christ for the Christian world. It has holistic places for the Muslims. For the Jews, we have the Mount Nebo. It also has places of historic civilizations, the Romans, the Byzantines, the Muslims. It's very rich in that. It's unique in its climate. It is much below the sea level, with the Dead Sea more than 400 meters below the sea level. It represents the food basket for the region. It's very important also for tourism. In many ways, it is very, very important, and it is unique in its characteristics, the environment, the water, the climate, the history. So there are many things within the Jordan Valley which is very important for the region and for the world as a whole. We think unless there are immediate actions taken by the governments in the region, allowing more fresh water to flow to the Jordan River as it used to be in the past, and to repair the Dead Sea level to a certain level, we will lose the Jordan River, and it will be very difficult to get it back. That's our message for everybody.
Susie Hodges speaking there to Nadar Khatib, the Palestinian head of the environmental group Friends of the Earth, Middle East. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back on the air at this same time tomorrow. Don't forget you can always find all our news and feature programmes on the internet as well. Look us up at www.vaticanradio.org/English. Listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.